All right, so welcome. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Tim Guile, and I'm one of the interim guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. So this month I'll be teaching for Tuesdays of this March month. I was going to explore the topic of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so some of you are very familiar. Sometimes that might be a very fresh idea for you. But I want to approach it particularly from it as a practice, so not something that we just understand and kind of put it on the shelf, but actually something that permeates into our very lives, into our spiritual practice, in a very concrete way. Now, two themes I'd like to explore tonight and also all the way through this series is one that, as I said, Four Noble Truths as a practice. Because the Four Noble Truths are really one of the core teachings of the Buddha. So I hope to move us from a conceptual understanding of them to a direct understanding of how they show up in our lives and in our practice, and see them as a practice leading to awakening. And that's really the framework that forms why we practice. And that's, mindfulness is such a big part of our culture right now. You hear about mindfulness in schools. I actually teach mindfulness to my daughter's class, elementary school class. You hear it all these different applications. But when we bring in the Four Noble Truths, then we shift it from mindfulness into the Dharma. Okay, so the Dharma being what the Buddha taught, and particularly as a path to awakening and to a sense of liberation. Right? And so that's an important thing for myself anyway, that makes mindfulness, secular mindfulness, or applied mindfulness different from the Buddha Dharma. And often we look at the practice, we look at a concept like the Four Noble Truths as something that we have to acquire intellectually. But I'm going to encourage us to come into this very moment's unfolding, this moment's arising, as a place to see the Four Noble Truths, how they're actually arising in this moment, the quality of dukkha, the quality of the cause of dukkha, the end of that dukkha, the path to the end of that dukkha. Because this immediacy of practice is so essential. Because otherwise it's a sense of, well, I'll get to it eventually. When I go on enough retreats, when I get to these different states, these different insights, then I'll be able to really take it in. Instead, reorient your practice to this very moment. How am I meeting it? How am I showing up for what's arising right now in my life? Because if it's not in this moment, if it's not available in this moment, when will it be? So not delaying to a better time, but finding right in this moment, how can I meet this experience, this heartache, this difficulty, this joy, with the wisdom that comes through understanding these Four Noble Truths? Because otherwise we tend to get caught in chasing experiences, chasing some state that we think is better than where we are, what we hope will give us what we're seeking. And it's just in front of us what is needed. So whatever this moment contains, that way we can start to make this ancient teaching that the Buddha talked about 2,600 years ago applicable into our daily life. And how does it really show up in this daily moment, this daily life? And so the beautiful thing of it is that we don't have to change our lives. We just have to see whatever is present in our lives, whether we are parents, whether we have elderly parents we're taking care of, whether we have a job or we don't have a job, relationship, not a relationship, whatever color our skin is, our orientation towards sexuality, whatever manifestation that we take form in, that's actually the gateway for our practice, our awakening. You know, can I meet this moment just how it is, bring a sense of wisdom? There's a change of perspective that's really needed, a central change of position of how we relate to our lives that's needed, that grows through wisdom of practice. But can we meet this moment with the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths? Simple question is, am I moving toward more suffering or the end of suffering with how I'm meeting this moment? So this is the first theme, is looking at the Four Noble Truths as this practice that we really integrate into our lives. It shapes how we actually view our practice, shape the difficulty and joys of our life. The second theme is that the noble truths, we often approach it as this one and this one and this one. But I think it's much more helpful to look at it as a hologram, that each of these components are really part of a whole. So we look at one, we look at the truth of dukkha, we have to see it in the context of the end of dukkha, the sensation of dukkha. We have to see it in the context of how we use our lives, how we speak, how we act, how we make our living. And all these, and understanding the cause of it. So each week I'll focus on one of the truths, but try to broaden it out so we have this bigger sense of how they all fit together. So what are the Four Noble Truths? This would probably be a good question to come back to. So the Four Noble Truths are very simply stated, there's dukkha, there's a cause of that dukkha, there's an origination of that dukkha, there's a sensation of dukkha, and then there's a way leading to the sensation of dukkha. Now dukkha, I'm purposely not translating that because it's a Pali term that has a lot of more nuance than how we usually look at it. The ordinary Pali word for dukkha means suffering, means pain, misery, or sorrow. And so we, as English speakers, when we hear those words, they have a certain connotation. And then we all experience a certain amount of suffering. You know, this is hard. This is a difficult experience. We know what that is like. We know that there's pain, there's misery. There's this quality in our lives that through loss, through physical pain, mental pain, we experience this quality of suffering. But if we just leave it as translated as suffering, we sometimes miss the inherent dukkha in this moment, when things feel pretty good, when I have a full belly, I'm comfortable, you know, I don't have to worry about making my rent or my mortgage. There is still a level of dukkha that actually is very important to look at and to start to explore and address. So some of the nuances or the deeper meaning of dukkha are imperfection, impermanence, emptiness, unsubstantiality, a sense of things not being quite satisfactory. One analogy that Joseph Goldstein talked about is thinking of it as a wheel that doesn't quite fit the axis. So it's a little wobbly. So every time you go through life, it's a little bit of a jerky ride. So we'll come back to this definition of dukkha later on in the talk, but that's enough to get us started. So with dukkha, the Four Noble Truths, to return to that, that there is dukkha, there is a sense of unsatisfactoriness, of insufficiency. There is an arising of that dukkha, there's an origin. It's not just happenstance. It's not just accidental that it happens, it actually has a cause that we'll explore next week. There's a sensation of it. This is the good news, right? It's not just the Buddha taught there's suffering, but there's this end of suffering. And there's a way, there's a practice to leading to the end of that suffering. The Four Noble Truths, as you can see, really evolve or revolve around this concept or this idea of dukkha. Right? So dukkha is a conceptual thing, but it's actually something that's very much present in our life. There's very gross levels of it, and there's very subtle levels of it. And so we'll explore both of those tonight. And it's really a key premise of the Buddha's teaching. You know, it's like the underlying hypothesis that makes his whole teaching stand up. So it's important not to just kind of take my word for it or take the Buddha's word for it. And that's really your job as students, as sincere yogis and meditators, is to see how these show up in your life. To see, you know, is dukkha really a relevant concept for myself? Do I really experience dukkha? Is dukkha something that I want to understand? Do I want to see the cause of it? Is there something that I want to start to lessen in my life? Do I want to ease the dukkha? Am I have this sense of wanting to end dukkha? Can dukkha be fully released? So these are all questions that each one of us in this room have to answer for ourselves, to see very directly how it shows up. Is this something that's worth me putting my energy into, to really understanding. So tonight, I want to focus on the first noble truth. But I encourage you to see it as part of this much bigger whole. There's also the sensation of it. There's the cause of dukkha. There's the sensation. And there's the path to it. We'll tie some of those in through the talk. Now, traditionally, there's three kinds of dukkha that the Buddha spoke of. And so we'll start with that as a place to begin. The first type of dukkha is what's known as just the ordinary dukkha, ordinary suffering. Something that each one of us would agree if we experienced it, yeah, that's kind of hard. That's a difficult experience. So things like birth. Birth has its own dukkha, its own difficulty, sickness, old age, death. Is there anybody who's figured out a way to avoid those? Yeah. Also, association with unpleasant persons and conditions, separation from beloved ones and pleasant conditions, not getting what we desire. Grief, lamentation, and distress are all parts of this ordinary dukkha. Now, as I list those, as I was reading these and wanted to write them down and share them, I realized that many of us, when we hear those, we think, well, if I was a good meditator, if I really had my act together, I wouldn't be having those experiences. You know, I wouldn't mind if I was sitting with someone who's really annoying, someone difficult. I would be just fine with that. Or I'd be fine if someone I really loved left and died. I'd be just, okay, I'm just going to sit in the middle of that, and it's not going to be effective. Every one of those things I named, that's part of being human. It's part of the human condition. The Buddha himself experienced that. If you look at the suttas, he had a bad back. He had digestive trouble. I mean, he had people trying to kill him. And he got angry with people. Two of his most beloved disciples died very close to another. He said he felt like the whole light had gone out of the world. Right? So I think we sometimes overlay this expectation that if we are doing the right thing, we won't experience this ordinary dukkha. We won't experience this heartache. We won't experience physical pain. Association with unpleasant persons and conditions. Separation of beloved ones and pleasant conditions causes dukkha. So not all dukkha will go away. I think it's often a little confusing or discouraging for people when they hear these Four Noble Truths and they hear the third one, the sensation of dukkha. And they say, that means I'm never going to have pain again. I'm never going to have discomfort. So sometimes there's a sense of magical thinking or a sense of going to a heavenly realm. And if I get to escape, I won't have to have this kind of experience, these difficult experiences. But yet, here's a riddle for you. Can there be dukkha? Can there be the end of dukkha, even with the presence of dukkha? Can there be the end or sensation of dukkha, even when there still is a dukkha in our lives? Another way to say, can we experience pain, but without experiencing suffering from it? Can we experience physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain, but not feel like we're suffering in the midst of that? And it's that extra thing that we add, I think, is really the key piece of what we teach. Classically, this is known as the second dart. So this is kind of a graphic sutta where the Buddha says, imagine someone gets hit by a dart or an arrow. Okay? And if that person is well-trained, that's all they feel. They just feel the pain of that hurting their bodies. But if you're not trained, I mean, he says they beat their breast and cry out and scream and make a lot of extra pain. They basically stab themselves with the second dart. So that second dart is really, we start to, in practice, we learn that that's an optional thing. That's something we add to this moment's experience. I understood this very personally a number of years ago, actually, at this point. I had a kidney stone on a retreat. Right, so being a good meditator said, okay, I'm just going to feel this. And combined with being a bit stoic, I sat for 3 days just feeling this. I was in the hall, I was in the room, writhing in pain. So don't think of me as this, you know, too idealistic. But anyways, eventually I had to go to the ER and found out this was a kidney stone. So because I was just feeling the sensations of it, I was able to hold it pretty well. But I had another attack a few months later. The kidney stone was actually not gone. It was just waiting its time to start to move again. But when I had that pain, and I said, okay, this, I know what this is, it wasn't just the pain. It was the fear of that past experience. That is the second dart. And that was overwhelming. It's like, okay, I can't handle this. It's going to be another 10 days of pain, of cost, and just it became very quickly overwhelming. Even the experience itself, intense, it was enough I could hold, I could connect with. Right, so learning this, I really understood this second dart in that experience. So the fear, the worry that we add to suffering. So this is the first aspect of dukkha, this ordinary dukkha. And also understanding that each of these three aspects of dukkha, they actually interconnect. So we add to this dukkha, we see it later on in the third one. So second type of dukkha is that's produced as produced by change. Dukkha produced by change. Now Mary, or not Mary Oliver, but a poem called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. I love to fit that in as many times as I can. But just to quote a little piece of it, to feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth, what you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. Okay. The future that you so planned, that you said, okay, this is what the future is going to bring, to see that dissolve like salt. But what you've counted, okay, this is what I'm going to count on. So just for a moment, reflect on all the things that you count on in your life as being stable, as being long-lasting. Your job, your relationship, if you have one, your health, your finances, your life itself. Just realize that things that we count as being stable, they change. They are all inherently unstable. I was teaching a meditation class, and literally a student in that class came to the class, went home, and his house had burned down. And so that quality of things that we hold as being dear, they eventually will go away. And so we can't focus on that all the time, otherwise we'll be just a ball of anxiety. But to realize that when we hold things as being solid, that we hold things as being fixed, which inherently aren't, there is suffering that will arise when they do change, when they do shift. So this type of suffering, you know, grief is a natural part of that, that we lose things. We lose relationships, we lose parts of ourselves. You know, as we age, there's this process of our identity changing. The things are what we used to be able to do when we were 30, we can't do when we're 60. And it's this constant letting go of our experience. So grief is a natural part, natural and healthy way to approach that. If we love, we'll experience grief. But when we start to add outrage and denial to that, and not moving through that stage of denial, that's when we start to get really caught in the suffering inherent in this third type of dukkha, the dukkha of change. So the third kind of dukkha is that's the dukkha of conditioned states. Now this is the most subtle type of dukkha, but it's also the most radical. It's the most radical part of the Buddha's teaching. Because other types of dukkha, we can kind of learn to cope with that through psychological approaches, you know, having more, be well adjusted. We can be more graceful as those changes go through our lives, as we lose things. We can be more graceful as we experience pain. We can use things like secular mindfulness to help us deal with chronic pain. But this third kind of dukkha, it's really this fundamental sense of self that it's that causes that suffering, that difficulty. Sense of self and also of separation. The Buddha also talked about the Third Noble Truth as being, instead of just these three types of dukkha, in short, he said, just clinging to the five aggregates. I'm not going to go into the five aggregates in this talk, but it's basically the components of how we form a sense of self. What we hear, our senses, our thoughts, our activity, our consciousness. And so this is a very radical piece of the Buddhist teaching that really, it actually, event, at some point, it's, it will challenge each of us in a very profound way. Because we come up against this choice, do I want to continue to have my cake and eat it too? Do I want to continue to have this sense of intact self that's having experiences, that's everything self-referenced? Or am I willing to explore the truth of that, to see is it really a solid thing if I really connect with it? So that is very shaking as we go through practice. But as we go through that and see it, we start to realize actually understanding that leads to a deep release of suffering. Because all these other types of suffering, when they arise, when I lose someone, there's the pain of that, but there's also the sense of me that arises with that. When I have physical pain, when I have that kidney stone, there's the pain of it, there's the fear of it, but there's also the me, the sense of who I am in relationship to that. I can't take this, I can't bear this, I can't handle this. Now you start to loosen that sense of me that's experiencing it. There's still the experience, but there's not the ownership. And in that way, the dukkha really starts to shift, really start to loosen. That's really the one of the biggest, I think that's the most profound gift of this practice, is to shift from this isolated sense of self to something else. So we'll come back to this third one a little bit later in the talk. So dukkha, I'm going to suggest a different way of looking at it. Thinking of it simply in these two manifestations. One, the dukkha that is obvious. The dukkha that we all know, this is a hard experience. This is a difficult experience. We can tell someone about it and say, yeah, that sounds really tough. They're just very obvious. You know, my kidney stone or back pain, whatever kind of physical pain, you know, mental instability that has a very profound pain where we get caught in that not knowing where things are and just how our minds get so out of control. Emotional pain when we experience loss. You know, all these qualities are very obvious. We know when we're suffering. We know when we're having these. This includes the dukkha of dukkha, the dukkha of impermanence. And in that obvious one, as we talked about before, we add something to that, add that resistance, essentially, to that dukkha, and that compounds this dukkha, makes the suffering more intense, more prolonged. So often with dukkha, one teacher talked about physical pain in the body, the relationship to physical pain in the body, is analogous to the mental, the mind, and not knowing. That when the mind doesn't know something, when it doesn't know, you know, doesn't know where to fit it in or label it, that's like physical pain for the body. It's just very hard for the mind to open to that, to relax with that. So when we're having pain, we're having discomfort or suffering or some quality of dukkha, we're always trying to make a story around it. You know, what does this mean? What am I going to do about it? Whose fault is it? How can I never have this happen again? Trying to find this sense of meaning, this meaning-making tendency. Sometimes you hear someone who's religious in a, like in a Christian standpoint, ask, once they hear something very terrible or experience something terrible, they say, how can God let this happen? And so you hear that, and there's often, I'm very curious to see what the answer is if they ask a rabbi or a priest or someone, what is the answer to that question? And this is the mind's attempt to try to make meaning, to say, this is how things fit in. Everything fits into its box. And in that way, we feel very secure. Right? So that security is a manifestation of self, of trying to secure itself. And it's also a way it's a way to avoid feeling the dukkha fully, to do not fully grieve. The classic grief process has five steps, five stages of denial, negotiation, of anger, sadness, and acceptance. So when suffering arises in our life, when dukkha arises, there's often this negotiation, this kind of pushing it away. But sometimes when dukkha is obvious, but it's so dramatically obvious that there's no, it just sweeps all conception away, all coping strategies are just swept away. They're just, the only thing that's left is just to meet it so directly. There's a story in the suttas about this woman who lost her only child. And she was so grief-stricken, she got caught in the denial part of it and went around with her dead child in her arms to all these people saying, can you help get my child better? And people would look and know that that child was dead and know there's nothing they can do and say, I can't help you. And so she kept going to person after person after person. And finally someone said, well, I can't help you, but you should talk to the Buddha. So she went to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, okay, I can help your child. But what you have to do is give me one mustard seed from a house that has never experienced death or loss. So the woman was really excited. So she took her dead child and went to all these houses and asked, do you have a mustard seed? And they said, of course, we'll give you one. And then she had to ask, but have you ever experienced, has this household ever experienced a loss? Has anyone ever died in this family? And they said, well, yeah, actually someone has. So that same story is repeated household after household. Till finally she realized, oh, death touches everyone. No one is outside of that. And in that she was finally able to see that her child was dead. And was able to bury the child and then became a disciple of the Buddha. So the dukkha becomes so strong like that. Sometimes there is a denial that comes up. There's this pushing back. And in those times, it's really helpful just to acknowledge, yeah, this is a hard experience. Just because so often we just think if we were a better meditator, a better person, I wouldn't be experiencing this dukkha. But the first part of compassion is to acknowledge what is present. To actually say, okay, this is a hard situation. This is that little bit of acknowledgement becomes the seed that compassion can grow. And sometimes the dukkha is so strong, I was just experiencing that earlier this year, that I felt like any thought I had around it, any action I tried to take around this situation, I could just see led to more dukkha. There's no place to take root. It was so intense. No place to have a position of how to relate, to problem solve, to try to fix the dukkha. That all was left was to surrender to it, to allow it to wash away parts of myself, to allow myself to just be swept away by it. And then that's being swept away. You can see that there's this the stillness that arises from that. The sense that we're going into the third noble truth. This is the pathway of using dukkha as a gateway to awakening. So at times we'll experience that. You know, it's often very difficult times when we lose, someone dies who we very care about, something very traumatic happens or very difficult happens. And sometimes if our minds are able to approach it right, there's this deep surrendering into it. Other times, you know, we're just trying to stay alive and trying to keep our head above water. But if there's times when you just naturally, okay, I can just be empty in the middle of this. I've cried so much that all that's left is a sweet stillness. So this is the first kind of dukkha, the obvious dukkha. The second kind of dukkha, and this is just a suggestion, this isn't in the suttas, this dukkha is not so obvious. It's more unconscious. It's under the surface. So it's much more insidious. It's much more of what drives our actions, drives our lives, really. And in that way, it's actually, in some ways, more important to understand. Because the dukkha that's so obvious, we're naturally motivated to try to understand it, to try to be free of it, to try to deepen into it. But the dukkha that we don't notice is driving us, it's unconscious. And so that's where her sense of sincerity has to step up to be willing to look at the dukkha in this level. Really, this dukkha, you could classically say, is a manifestation of ignorance, not understanding how things are. So we could say dukkha in this perspective is the argument we have with how things are. And this is, it's this fundamental argument that the Four Noble Truths concerns itself with. The argument with how things actually are. So you can see in those other qualities of dukkha that things change, but we argue with that fact. You know, we make ourselves look younger. We try to avoid the fact that we will age. That we never experience pain. We tell these stories to ourselves. Some sage was asked, I think it was Shantideva, was asked, what is the most wonderful thing that you, the most amazing thing that you know of? And there's the person asking the question thought it'd be some, you know, mystical thing. And he said that what's the most amazing to me is that people are dying all around us and we think it will never happen to us. that was the most amazing thing, that we have that level of ignorance. So how really are things? If we say dukkha is the denial or the argument with that. So the Buddha described life in this way. He was talking to a Brahmin. He said, "Oh Brahmin, it's just like a mountain river. It's just like a mountain river, flowing far and swift, taking everything along with it. There is no movement, no instant, no second where it stops flowing, but goes on flowing and continuing. So Brahmin, is human life like a mountain river." So since that things aren't fixed and solid, but they're always in flux, always changing. Heraclitus said it this way, "You cannot step twice into the same river, for fresh waters are ever flowing in on you." So any moments arising, any moments unfolding, it's really not a static thing. That's why I like to think of it as this arising instead of this moment's experience. What am I experiencing, am I having? What is the moment? Because even that kind of language, there's still a sense of fixation or a sense of locking it in. Locking meaning it becomes a noun. I had an experience, of this or of that, and it becomes solid. It's like taking a cup of a pitcher of the river and saying, "This is the river." Okay, it's no longer the river. The river is inherently part of this flow. So taking it out of its flow means it's no longer a part of that. So any moment, even this moment right now, notice how if you kind of settle back a little bit, you can see how things are always in flux. There's this moment's unfolding of sound, of sensation, of smell, of sight, there's thoughts. And in the next moment, they've gone to a different way. Right? So each moment is this constant flow of experience. If we fix it and say, "This is who I am," or "This is mine," we fixate the object, and we also fixate the observer. We form in relationship to it. So this is using the word arising, the unfolding of this moment's reality, puts it back into a verb, the verb of action, of unfolding, of actually doing something. So we look at the third noble truth for a moment. The way I'm going to approach it is it's a sense of having nothing coming between us and that unfolding. Even that is too much. There's still a sense of me observing the river. Ultimately, to go into the third noble truth means to step into that river, to not hold ourselves outside of that unfolding, outside of that arising of this moment and the falling away of that moment. So there's this way of moving, going into life's change. So there's a sense of aliveness, there's a sense of spontaneity that naturally is present. There's a sense of ease because you're in harmony with this. And so dukkha, any moment of not joining with that unfolding, observing it, pushing it away, claiming it as me, or even just observing it. Okay, I can see things arising and passing away, but I'm not allowing myself to fully join that arising and passing away. That's a moment of dukkha. So this is a very subtle quality of this dukkha. But if we start to understand that, the subtle qualities start to take care of the much bigger qualities. The subtle way of relating, because that's really how we form ourselves. If we understand how we form ourselves, the much grosser ways and much more overt ways we suffer, we add that secondary suffering, that secondary dart, start to fall away. So anytime that we're imposing a belief, even a label, an agenda, an idea of how things should be, a sense of ownership to this moment's arising, dukkha is present. So you think, you know, right now in the country there's this wonderful awakening around racial inequality, how much pain has been caused by white privilege, of sense of assumptions of things. And we all have these assumptions of the other person, however you might define it. And in that assumption, we're fixating. And in that fixating, we're creating dukkha for ourselves and for others. If we come into the, really opening into the flow of life and the flow of this other person, then there's no longer that dukkha that arises. And then naturally there's compassion. Compassion's a natural byproduct of that. Kindness is a natural byproduct. As Naomi Shihab Nye says, only kindness makes sense anymore. Now it's tricky, this type of dukkha is very sneaky and tricky, because in the moment, it doesn't feel like dukkha. Like if I'm really excited about something, I'm really engaged about something, I'm really adamant about a political belief, for example, there's a sense of really feeling intact, that we kind of get juice from that. We get a sense of empowerment from that. So in the moment, it doesn't feel like dukkha. It feels like this is me being powerful. But if we look closely, we're actually distancing ourselves from this flow. That eventually that's the way we've taken form, we've taken birth, will eventually die. And in that dying, there'll be suffering. Because any type of abstraction from life, ultimately, there's a dissonance, there's a difficulty. Sometimes it's very subtle that we can barely notice, or it's unconscious, and sometimes it's very obvious. So you learn to tune to the very subtle, then the much more obvious falls away. Whenever I'm able to go to the beach and, you know, play in the waves, I like to play in the surf, you know, feel the surf. There's a sweet spot where the waves aren't crashing down on you, but they're lifting you up. And sometimes I like to just go out there and let the waves lift me up, feel the power of the wave go through, and then recede. And so that's this feeling of being in the middle of life, that there's this emotion that comes through, this whatever it might be, a hindrance. The hindrances themselves can be seen as just this manifestation of life. They don't have to have any friction. They don't have to have this judgment around. We can just allow it to flow through us. But if I'm too far back on the beach and the waves are crashing down on me and I get sucked back under in the undertow, it's allowing the waves to go through without being caught in them. So bringing our attention to the ways that we hold ourselves out from this unfolding, that's what the homework points toward. It starts time to time this week, whether you're sitting in a sitting practice, walking practice, or just gazing at nature or talking to someone. Just notice how there's this constant flow of arising. Shift into seeing things as a verb instead of a noun. Seeing how this person's experiencing this, they're experiencing that. If I allow myself to join that and be a part of that flow, notice how there's a natural ease that arises from that. And also notice when you don't do that, when you fixate and say, you know, you should be this way, or I should be this way, I should be more of that way, how that feels, how that fixation feels to lock things in. And recognize that as dukkha. That this is dukkha that's present. not to judge it, because that's the judgment is actually another fixation. Just to notice how it arises, to start to understand it. Now often, when we talk about this way of relating to life, people ask about, well, what about action? What am I supposed to do with my daughter or my partner or my job or these different actions? Because this, when you hear it this way, it is a very, in some ways, it's not that passive because you're very much engaged, but it's not so directive. So what about action? So we look at the Four Noble Truths. The fourth one, I think, is where action comes back in. Right? And it's framed by looking at the, you know, how dukkha is, actually is in our life, how the cause of it, the end of it, and that frames how our actions are. See, transformation happens, it can only happen in this moment, in this moment's relation, in how we relate to this moment's experience. In that moment's arising, there's a choice to sign up for more suffering in the future, to reaffirm our suffering, our patterns of contraction. And there's also the choice of releasing that. Right? So as this moment arises, that's where the transformation is potentially able to be happen. In that moment, that's where the transformation happens. Okay? From that, that informs our actions, how we actually choose to speak, act with our bodies, how we choose to make a living. And I think with livelihood, one of the eightfold path, I think it's important to kind of expand it beyond just how we earn money to actually how we are in the world. How do we actually, you know, what's our carbon footprint? How we are around people who are other than us that we may want to push away or be afraid of or judge? You know, how are we with our friends and our family? So it's much more how do we actually show up in life? And so these major choices, decisions, you know, it really happens, it's really informed by this moment-by-moment transformation. And having this relationship to the moment-by-moment unfolding, it allows us to make course corrections. I choose to go plan B, and I feel this contraction, I feel myself getting locked in thought and in worry. It's a time to reassess and maybe make a course correction. So more about that on the fourth noble truth. But you can see how there can be very much an integration of these Four Noble Truths. So the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha. So taking in, you know, see where's the dukkha arising in this moment. You know, sometimes it's very obvious, the physical pain. Sometimes you can see, okay, I'm really adding my resistance to this moment's experience. The secondary dukkha, the dukkha of the second dart. Sometimes there's the dukkha of I just lost this relationship and the inherent pain of that. And where do I start to shift into the second dart? And then more subtly noticing how this unfolding, this natural unfolding of this moment, when I align with that, when I join with that, so there's no separation from that, there's a natural harmony. And when I push it away, when I try to lock it in, that's where dukkha arises in a very subtle way. Subtle, but at the same time, very very core, very close to how we form ourselves. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And as you sit, just noticing, not going into your meditative mode, but just noticing what is present. And seeing it as a changing phenomenon. And to some measure, allowing yourself to surrender into that flow, into that change. this arises, and this passes away. Surrendering. Okay, thank you. So I appreciate any comments or questions you might have. The comments really help flesh out the talk, help me see places that could be enhanced upon or any areas of confusion. And it's actually one of my favorite parts of the evening. So if there's any questions or comments. Yes.
That really is the way life is, and that one of the deeper things I experience is I keep wanting to make it smooth, and so when I notice in the morning often when I haven't established the things that, you know, shape me and form me and kind of, I don't know, locked in. I don't know what it is. It makes me feel more, what I think is more secure. And I can kind of sense this wobbliness and that I have resistance. And it's a very low key, like my mind will be saying, well, you know, everything's fine and, you know, there's nothing to worry about and you're going to be doing this today. And you know, there's my mind kind of thinking that it's telling me you're okay and this is the way to make sure you're okay. But the real problem is underneath with not accepting that it can't be okay. It can't be that kind of okay. I don't know. It's a very subtle, because I like the idea of the subtleness of it and that I'm resisting that wobbly imperfection.
Yes, yes. So just to repeat it for the video is that there's appreciating the sense of dukkha being this things don't quite fit right, this sense of wobbliness, and noticing how there's a tendency to want to shore that up, to try to smooth things out, get that axis so it's just perfect. But underneath that, you can see from all the actions, there's this unrest, not wanting it to be wobbly. And Lauren, what you said, I think, is really an essential piece of inquiry to really notice that, to direct your attention to that more and more. Not to discount that. There's a little bit of ways. I'm not sure if that's worth looking at. It is really worth looking at. Because usually we get so distracted by trying to make that unsatisfactoriness, that wobble, not be there. I mean, if you look at our lives, that's what most of our life is about. You know, one meditation teacher I heard about at the teacher training from Asia, her whole practice for people was just to notice when you move from suffering, when you move from that unsatisfactoriness, that sense of wobble, and notice every move, you know, and start to realize almost every movement is trying to avoid that, trying to make that better or to smooth it out. And you can see there's all these big strategies that, you know, do help our lives go smoother. I mean, it helps if we are organized and on time. This helps life work. So we can't all give it up all at once. But to realize that it's never going to, inherently, it's a losing battle. It's like trying to build a sandcastle. And I told a story a while ago that my daughter, when she was young, they were building a sandcastle. But the tide was coming in, and they were trying to put dams up and dikes and stuff, but the waves kept coming, right? So that's that trying to hold back that. Okay, so underneath that, if you start to be very tender with it, because there's a tremendous amount of really existential pain around that. Start to realize, okay, what that the pain of trying to make things be smooth when they're not smooth, right? And just letting that much. Just become very tender and quiet with it. Because underneath that, you start to eventually realize when you look at it without trying to change or get rid of it, but just to fully understand it. See how many different permutations, manifestations it has. And then you fully see it, something else will emerge. And that's when that emerges, that is stepping into the instability and actually enjoying it. Say, okay, this wave is moving me this way. Wow. You know, there's that, instead of like trying to stop the waves. And then you start to realize, I see my heart opening. I see the stress falling away, that the suffering falls away in a very deep way. Thank you. Yes?
I think this talk itself was kind of a lesson that
Oh, good.
That was like a lesson of this practice.
Good. So the comment was that before the talk, the anticipation of talking about dukkha and suffering and death was like the worst nightmare. But actually, the experience of the talk was other than that, that it felt like it was a teaching in itself of looking at dukkha in its own way. Could you articulate that a little bit more, what it felt like it changed for you? Beautiful. Yeah, it's with dukkha, or with, let's take something that's like death or suffering, all those qualities. Remember the Buddha, he talked about the end of that. You know, he talked about how everything changes, but he also talked about what doesn't change. And so we so much are trying, as Lauren was talking about, trying to make things that are changing not change. And you know, that includes our lives itself, or you know, death, there's all this denial around it. But we, as we really open to that and actually acknowledge it, we realize it's actually not so bad. It's like this is happening whether I want it or not. So there's a lightness just to acknowledge it. But it doesn't stop there, because we by really working with it, we start to approach it in a way that is outside of change. What doesn't change? What is the deathless? Thank you. Hi, yes. Thank you. And so the comment was just talking about racial inequality and how it was helpful to explore it. It's, you know, it's tragic how we miss people because of this projection of how we think they should be. And we don't ever get through that to actually see the beauty of this person. And it's tragic because we were locking ourselves in as much as we're locking them in. And so I think we all have areas that we kind of, where this has happened to us. You know, in terms of race, I mean, just the thing is, there's such a systemized oppression of that. It becomes so embedded, and there's so much hatred that it is very oppressive to that. And so, you know, talking about it and being willing to talk about it is part of the healing process. So thank you for sharing. Yes, George.
Thank you.
Right.
So for me, the practice is making it a little bit less quality.
Yes,
so
yes.
It's about the suffering that I, the second dark kind of suffering. I don't know if there's any more cycle in there except that I felt like it's not all.
I'm glad you brought that up because, so the question or the comment was that opening, surrendering to the wobbliness, sometimes that's what's needed. It's really learning how to have less wobble in the system is what's needed. And that's, it's like we have to have a certain, it's this paradox. We have to be stable enough to be able to let go. You know, not stable in terms of being, and there's a sense of being like, this is this kind of confidence of, okay, I'm basically okay inside. Right? And often that's actually a big jump for a lot of us, is to have that sense of okayness. The sense of, okay, there's a sense of generally caring for my well-being, a sense of compassion for my experience. And that is a prerequisite to be only open to the wobbliness. Because if we don't have that, then there's so much self-hatred, so much self-dislike that's just constantly going on. And there is just feel like everything is unstable. And learning how to find that point of stability. That's why I emphasize in the beginning class how to sit in a good posture. Because that inherently teaches the body to be stable. And so it starts to go into the psyche, into those wounds, those traumas. Okay, can I be still in the middle of this? Even in a single meditation, like this morning, this evening when I was sitting, you know, the first bit, my mind was distracted, I was sleepy, there were all these things going on. And so a lot of it was just trying to find a point of stability. Okay, where's the breath? Okay, there's the breath. Okay, there's a lot, the breath is lost. Come back to the breath. So that sense of returning, that helps to stabilize. And then once there's a sense of stability, then there's more of this opening into releasing into the wobbliness, not willing to be held. But if I tried to open to that too soon, I just got lost in it. Right? And so same thing with our actions of our lives. You know, if our life is really chaotic and there's a lot of stuff that's not going well, we have to shore that up, kind of get our house in order before we let it burn down. Yeah, but it's really important. Yeah, so don't feel like you have to go really acknowledge where each one of us is. And it's not like a developmental thing. It's really acknowledging what's present in this moment. Because each one of us, throw the dice, have the right conditions arise, lose your job, you know, get a chronic illness, you know, get a divorce, be bankrupt, and let's see how we are, you know? Yeah, and so just to realize it's, we're not that far away from that instability. So learning to have that, having that be really a refuge, that the body is a refuge of stability, be able to call that forth, because we will need it. Each one of us will need that. Okay, I have to call forth that stability. And eventually from that stability, there may be a way to open. Yeah. Thank you. All right, probably one more question, if there is one. Yes?
Can you speak maybe a little more to the third kind of dukkha that you mentioned, which is more the very subtle one about self or isolation?
Sure. Sure, the dukkha, that's the dukkha of conditioned states, conditioned experience. So conditioned experience is really our past history, you know, whether it's our way we were trained to relate around things like race or sexual orientation, gender, all these age, all these qualities, how we relate to ourselves, I'm a good person or a bad person. Those are all conditions that show up in this moment. So we form around that. It's like there's this analogy that just came to mind, like, you know, those factories that keep dropping, you know, there's like something that drops down and like this glob of something, and then this next machine makes it into something else. It's like we have all this factory going in, set of conditions arise, and we pop up with this kind of a, this is the Tim that's showing up to meet this situation based on my past history. So inherently in that formation, there's a quality of dukkha. And so that's actually most of the talk was trying to explore that, the latter part about the sense of being aligned with the unfolding, with the arising, and the not alignment with it is that third dukkha, that third type of dukkha, wanting to fixate to try to form. Just think of it like with the rivers flowing by, instead of being part of that flow, you're trying to take a bucket and say, this is how it is. But you've separated it out. The act of separating out that water from the flow is dukkha in itself.
And so that is the self, that this is my who I am, is this part of the river that I've taken out is a kind of a false sense.
Right, yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the dukkha, the sense of saying this bucket is who I am. Yeah. And that's a sense of identity. Like you can see it when you have that self-talk, you make a mistake and there's self-talk, I'm such a this and that, you know, all that. That is rehearsing is really forming that bucket, saying this is who I am. Right? But in reality, if you look closely, that self, since the self is constantly flexing and changing, there may be certain patterns or tendencies that we've really rehearsed, but it really changes. You know, notice how many different thoughts you have during the day, different states of emotion that you're really, I'm feeling sad in this time, I'm feeling angry in this time, I'm feeling happy. Those are all different senses of self that are arising in that. Yeah, so it's a subtle training, teaching, but it is really essential to start to understand it. So a nice gateway into it is, there's many gateways, but from around dukkha, just notice that when something that's difficult arises, notice how you feel about it, the sense of trying to push it away. Think of it as resistance is a big part of that sense of self. The sense of pushing away or pulling toward you is both resistance, and that's the sense of self. I think it's easier to see the footprints of the sense of self than the actual sense of self itself. Yeah, I think that's more helpful to focus on how it manifests than trying to get a strong sense of it. Looking at how it manifests, eventually you start to see the release of it. Because trying to find it, it's actually, you look, it's you can't find it. But you can see how it acts. You can see how that action itself is empty. Okay. All right, thank you for your questions and sincerity, your comments.